This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2019, held at Faith Builders from July 29 through August 2.
Okay, so I think we'll get started, and if people trickle in, that's okay. So how many of you have taught high school history before? Okay, that's sort of an assumption. I made the assumption that the majority of you will have taught before. How many of you have taught high school history for more than 5 years? Okay, good. I'm glad there's some greater experience in the room. My name is Nate Nolt, and I'm married to Hannah Nolt, formerly Scott. She's the art teacher around here. And I've taught for 6 years in high school. Five of those I've taught history. Primarily. I teach at Terry Hill Mennonite High School, and we're a school of 100 students in grades 9 through 12. So my experience in the high school classroom is with anywhere between 25 and 30 students in a single class. Freshman is world history, sophomore American history, junior year church history. And so I probably have a little bit of a different experience than what you do in the classroom. I just want to acknowledge that. So if I say something and it doesn't make sense to you, it might be because we teach at slightly different schools, but hopefully we can learn from each other. The other thing, I taught for 2 years in the sixth and seventh grade classroom where I was in charge of everything. And one of the things that's different in my current position is that a bell rings at 7:58 in the morning, and then another one rings at 8 o'clock, and all students are supposed to be in their homeroom at that moment. We have 2 minutes of homeroom, and at 8:02 another bell rings, which is the signaling of the start of church history. And I must do church history with those students for 50 minutes. In sixth and seventh grade, if it was a review day in history class, after about 20 minutes or something, you could move on. And I don't know, my experience is sort of shaped by the bell. Maybe y'all's high schools do that too, but that's also another piece to what I bring to this discussion. This talk is not a like, these are all the pieces that you need to have in your high school history class. It's just like random. In some ways, it's like an ADD thing on teaching high school history. And it's just because sometimes at Teachers Week, you can get sort of sick of like, you must do all these things. And it's sort of nice just to hear someone reflect. And so this is sort of a reflection, a mixture of pieces from the philosophy of history to a bunch of other things. So, in my description, I talked about history class saying something about the human condition, and I think that one of the great things about teaching history is you're able to share with your students the human condition for the last 6,000 years. I have this thing in my head, and I've been teaching for 5 years, and I've not even believed this thing for like 10 years. But we have this thing in our head that we are more advanced than the people who lived 100 years ago, that we're somehow better than the people who lived 100 years ago, because I just received a text message in my pocket from somebody else, and that's like a really awesome telegram, you know? And so we think ourselves better today than we were 100 years ago as a human race. That's not true. We are actually remarkably similar to the descendants of Adam and Eve, okay? And history tells us these things. All right, so I'll be talking more about that. One of the things I was thinking about this, the piece about the human condition, and I found it interesting that one of the most well-known passages of Scripture. If you keep reading after John 3:16, it actually says that this is the human condition. Okay, so for God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him. Whoever believes in him is not condemned, but whoever does not believe is condemned already, because he has not believed in the name of the only Son of God. This is the solution to the human condition. But then the next verses tell us the human condition. And this is the judgment. That light has come into the world, and people love the darkness rather than the light, because their works were evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light, and does not come to the light, lest his works should be exposed. But whoever does what is true comes to the light, so that it may be clearly seen that his works have been carried out in God. Light has come into the world. I believe that God working with his people across the ages has been light. But people prefer darkness, okay? And that is true of every generation of human beings that has existed. It's the basic motivating factor in any event that has happened in history, okay? All right, so some philosophical pieces about teaching high school history. Switching gears just a little bit. I sort of alluded to this, but I think that history whispers wisdom to us. Not just knowledge, but wisdom, okay? We can become wise as we look at history. And one of the ways we can become wise is from understanding that the human condition has changed. Has stayed the same throughout history. We have not changed, okay? And so looking at the past, we can actually understand our present, right? And if we don't look at our past, we probably will not understand our present. It's one of the reasons why, as a history teacher, I do not like STEM or STEAM as the new model is going, because it's focused all on science and technology and math, which are wonderful things. But if we don't understand our history, okay, and there I just used the word we, and you will hear a soapbox on that one just a little bit later, but if people do not understand their history, they're going to repeat it, which they probably will anyway, because we're human beings. Okay. Just a little bit of pessimism thrown in there. All right. A second philosophical piece. You as a teacher are one of the most important things in a history classroom. Not that you have a great, like, lesson plan and you have all the words written down exactly. Most of the time, the reason a teacher is important in the classroom is because of the descriptive words that the teacher puts to events. Okay? It's like in those subtle things that you choose to say. Okay? So when you're mentioning the President of the United States, okay, what descriptive words do you choose when you talk about the President of the United States? Okay? Those subtle things change the history classroom. Okay? How you talk about the United States invasion of Iraq, okay? And not like the facts of the situation, the descriptive words you use about it, okay? So the teacher is an important component in the history classroom, the worldview of the teacher. And you know what? My worldview is continually shaped by my students, okay? Because students are way more consistent than what I am, okay? My students hold me to a higher standard than I hold myself, okay? And some of it's because I disagree with some of their analysis and understandings of the world. But they're great at holding me accountable, and they've shaped my worldview a lot. As a history teacher, I entered the classroom 5 years ago, and I thought, when my students leave the classroom, this is the kind of person they are going to be. As educators, we actually talk about these kinds of things. Like, after a student goes through our program, what kind of student do we want? We can't actually do that. I mean, it's a good thing to talk about. It's a good philosophical question to wrestle with and so on and so forth. But you cannot change your student's worldview or your heart or their heart. Jesus does that. All right? Now, can you expose them? Can you lead the horse to water? Absolutely. Okay? But you cannot make the horse drink. And so, in the history classroom, I have found that when I let go of the fact that I don't actually have to feel responsible for changing my students' view on whether the earth is flat or round, like, that's not actually my job to change that student, because I can't. Can I expose him to the truth? Yes. Okay, I can do that. That's one thing I can do. But I can't actually change my student. All right. Now, I can make him say a correct answer on a test. All right. I have found that history is full of tension. And we like making history black and white. Your history textbook likes making history black and white. But history is just full of tension. So let's take the American Revolution for just a very basic example. If the American colonists would have lost, it would have been called the American Rebellion. Okay? But all of a sudden, we have a revolution on our hands. Okay? And it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. And so the tensions that exist in history are just like everywhere. And as a history teacher, you need to actually be okay with that tension. And you actually need to share with your students the tensions of history. As Anabaptists, we are in a great place to do this. Because our loyalty is to a kingdom that is not of the earth. Okay? And it enables us to present all the tensions, because the agenda that we have is actually the agenda of our King Jesus. All right, it's not the agenda of the United States of America or Canada or Belize or from wherever you're from. Finally, with compassion and love for all, okay, your students should hear you being compassionate towards Hitler. As a person, Hitler did many evil things, but he was under grace until he died. All right? And I have nothing but compassion for a man who could do the things that Hitler did. I have nothing but compassion for the Jewish people and the Roma people and the people with mental and physical disabilities that the Third Reich would destroy and ruin. But we can't select our compassion, because I believe as Christians we must be compassionate and loving towards all things. That does not mean that we say that all actions are right. Okay, we don't need to say that, you know, Hitler was, you know, a fine man. We don't have to say that. But the person of Hitler is somebody to be pitied. And somebody to have compassion and love for. I'm going to put an image up here that is going to demonstrate all of these pieces in sort of one picture, and then I'm going to make some comments about it. Okay. So this is President Trump. In the media, we are told that President Trump is not fit to be president. I'm not going to discuss that particular piece, but I would like to call us to Andrew Jackson, an early president in United States history. He challenged at least 100 men to a duel. Okay, in the one instance where he actually killed the other guy, they walked their paces and turned around. And he waited for the other guy to shoot first. That was his strategy. And according to the story, the bullet actually hit him. And he put his hand over the place where the bullet went in, and he aimed at the other guy, and the flint didn't actually make contact. And so in the rules of dueling, you actually have to wait to leave the duel until the other guy actually fired a shot, okay? And so the thing just so clicks, but doesn't actually, the bullet doesn't go off. And so he recocks the pistol and shoots the guy in the chest, and the guy dies the next day. Now, I'm not likening President Trump to Andrew Jackson, but we can look at American history, and President Trump is not the only president that didn't have the temperament to be president, okay? And if we get rid of the notion that we are, as humans, are getting better, and actually believe a more biblical understanding that our hearts are tended toward darkness, it actually whispers wisdom to our present age and helps bring clarity to our present age. So when you talk about President Trump, what adjectives do you choose? Okay. The teacher is important. I try with all my power to use the word President Trump, President Obama, Mr. Obama, Mr. Trump, Secretary of State Clinton, and so on. Okay. And I try to offer zero spin. Okay. Now, my heart is tended towards darkness as well. And so I just acknowledge that there are some days that I have to apologize to my students. Your students might be dyed-in-the-wool Republicans if you teach in suburban America. If you teach in the urban setting, you might have people who are anti-Trump. You can't change the worldview of your students. Okay, that doesn't mean you can't say some things. I've had plenty of discussions. But how you respond in those things is important. History is full of tension. When you look at the records of the last four presidents, it's full of tension. Okay, Bill Clinton had the Monica Lewinsky scandal, but the United States actually had a budget surplus under his rule. You could argue as to why and how and all that stuff. But every president, I'm just using presidents as an example here, every president has like this tension within them. Okay. President Obama did some good things. He did some things that were not so good. Why? Because his heart is tended towards darkness, and just like you and I. Okay, let's have compassion and love for all. Okay, I'm moving off of some of those reflections and moving on to content scope. This is a bit of a rapid shift. Hopefully, you're ADD enough to follow me. Content scope. The reason I'm talking about this is the great big question I've asked myself over the last 5 years is, how is my high school history class any different from the elementary class that they had? So where in the state of Pennsylvania and the schools that come, the kids who come to our school, all of them have had American history in grade school. All of them have had world history in grade school. And so I'm teaching them world history and American history again. Okay? How is my high school class different from an elementary class? Do I focus on vocabulary like they do in elementary? Like, what's the difference between high school history and elementary history? I haven't fully gotten to this is the difference. But here are some thoughts. Our high school students are not as sheltered, and they shouldn't be as sheltered as an elementary school student. And so you should be able to talk about issues in history that you wouldn't necessarily talk about in the elementary classroom. And so you can have discussions about the sex revolution. You can have discussions about Anne Boleyn and Henry the Eighth's wives, and you can have discussions about my brain is going blank here, and I'm getting really insecure because I'm like, oh wow, he's just talking about sex. But the high school history classroom offers greater the ability to have deeper discussions about issues that you couldn't talk about in the elementary classroom. High school history, you can also give them the basic facts of something and have them analyze it. Okay, so one of the things, and you could do this in elementary class too, I guess, but the Boston Massacre, I have my kids read the account of the captain from the British perspective, and then I have them read what the Boston Gazette said about the British, the Boston Massacre. And you can actually have your kids say, like, okay, so is this actually, is the word massacre actually a good word to use here? Like, what can we say that it was all the British the British captain's fault, or is it the Bostonians that were doing the, like, and all of a sudden you can actually help your high school students actually see the complexity of it all, and to actually say, well, as most fights go, there were problems on both sides, and so that's the nuance of history. And I think you can help high schoolers their brains are beginning to be able to see some of that nuance. The other thing about content scope that I'd like to talk about is history is so big. And sometimes I talk to other people who teach history and they're talking about some obscure, well, this just happened. I was talking, we were in the Netherlands and we were taking a walk with some of our friends, and my host was asking me if I knew about this certain battle in World War II, and I had no idea what the battle was. And he's like, you don't know about the battle of, and I forget what it was. I felt really insecure in that moment because I didn't know about the battle of this particular thing in World War II. History is so big that there's no way you can know everything. And so when you're looking at what you should teach your students, look at your strengths, okay? And your strength might be different from somebody else's strength, and that's okay, all right? Because it's better for you to teach a part of history that you're excited about than to muddle through a section that you're not quite sure what to do with, okay? Now, teaching Asian history is difficult. I'm slowly learning Asian history, but my education was predominantly Western civilization, and I think it's important that we see the world in a global perspective. And so we do need to educate ourselves in the things that we don't know about. But if you're a first year teacher or whatever, focus on the things that you know, because the scope of history is so massive. Okay, you sort of have to pick what you're going to do, use your strengths to do that. And so we reach the depth versus breadth thing. Do you go deep in one area or do you show the scope of things? I think that in elementary and in high school, what you're trying to do is create the broad picture and go deep in a few areas along that broad picture, so that when the student leaves school and interacts with the world, they can keep going deep and adding to the breadth. So I think it's important that our students see the overarching scope of all of human history. And to get ahead of myself, when I draw timelines on the board, I actually love drawing the 6,000-year timeline, even for American history. Okay. Now, it's difficult if you're, you know, sometimes you have to use a shorter one. But sometimes I draw a 6,000-year timeline over here and show, like, okay, we're talking about this much of history, and then draw the shorter one over here to reinforce in my students' brains that there's, like, a big overarching story in history. And the more you know about history and what has happened, you can sort of, like, plug it in the place on the great breadth of history. So The other thing about depth versus breadth, this next year, Terry Hill's getting new curriculum for history. It's the year to redo the history curriculum. And we've gone with McGraw-Hill, but there's several other secular texts are doing this, and I think maybe Rodden Staff has done this too with high school history, where in world history, it's called Modern Times. It goes from about 1500 to present. And in United States history, it goes post-Civil War. I think they might do post-Reconstruction, I believe, to present. And we've done this because in elementary school, you start at the beginning, right? Well, no, I don't know. I know a very few history teachers that actually make it to present. Okay, most of the time, I'm doing 1940 to present in about a week of, like, fast PowerPoints where, like, students are, like, already out of school, and I'm, like, trying to be excited about Ronald Reagan, okay? I mean, I'm not saying that was not a value judgment on Ronald Reagan. So that's one of the things that we've done to limit the scope. It offers summaries of the, like, the first two chapters of the book are sort of summaries of the beginning, but then it starts going deep. Talk to me next year if that was a good idea or not. The other reason we did that is it feels like the school movement started about 130 years ago or something, and they had less history to teach in 1890 than we do in 2019. And history textbooks have with all the technology, we've documented the last 130 years really well. And so we know too much about the last 130 years. And so that has also played itself into it, because this is probably a 600-page text. If you get the version of this book that is the total history, it's over 1,000 pages. And so in the scope of 1 year, there's no way that you could get through the scope of history unless you start cutting things. All right. Some instruction pieces in the history classroom. I love timelines. I don't love them enough. I need to love them more. Timelines need to be explained. I've found that in my history classroom. There are still some people who don't understand, some students who don't understand how you can put time on a line. And you can see why, because, like, it's actually sort of an abstract concept. Like, let's put time on a line, okay? And, like, this represents 6,000 years. It's a bit of an abstract concept. And if somebody had to do timelines their whole elementary grade during their elementary years and they didn't actually get it, they're probably not going to get it if you just draw a timeline on the board and say, here's a timeline. So I try very hard to, like, demonstrate what a timeline is. Sometimes it's helpful for them to draw a timeline of their life, okay? And some kids struggle with spatial recognition, okay? Like, actually knowing that, like, this can represent 100 years, and this is, like, 110, okay? Like, some kids don't understand that spatial recognition, so, like, this is 100 years, and this is 110 years, like, very much the same. Okay, so explain timelines over and over and again. I find that's the great thing in high school history, because in high school history, I can get into my head a lot and start being all about the stories and so on, and I forget that there's some basic things that students are still struggling to actually understand, like timelines, outlines, writing a paragraph. I mean, most of our students are probably competent in some of those things, but, like, we do actually need to remind them how to do these things. So think about that as you do your timelines and so on. I often use the 6,000-year timeline as much as possible. I said that before. I use timelines. Sometimes I make them recall timelines. For tests, I will give them a list of events, and they have to place them on the timeline. I rarely do matching things, because that just enables, like, process of elimination and stuff, like if you do, if you draw your own timeline and put little marks there and say this is A, and then you just need to match up the phrase with A, well, you can sort of figure some things out, and it's like process of elimination going on. Second thing that I use, maps and globes. First of all, maps. I like maps for example, in world history, I'll often do one where they can label the Nile civilizations, the Fertile Crescent, the Indus River Valley ones, and sort of look at some of the places where civilization sort of cropped up. And if you put geography along with that, you can sort of have conversations about, oh, why are these people settling? Like, what's common about where these people are settling and so on? And you can have sort of bring geography into your talk. And so drawing on maps, talking about geography, mountain ranges, if you, like, there's so much you can talk about. I'm making it sound like every single lesson I'm using a map and talking about geography. That's not true. I am a human being. and so map exercises often take a lot of prep time and energy, and so I use them a few times throughout the year. I also have a giant 3-foot globe. You can buy them for $30 on Amazon. It's an inflatable globe. You have to figure out classroom culture, because when you have a giant beach ball globe in the front of the classroom, you sort of have to have some procedures for high school students. This year, I just ordered a more exciting one. I have a political one, and a more exciting one is actually like a topographical one that shows mountain ranges and stuff. I'm not exactly sure where it's going to fit in my classroom, but it's going to fit. I love using globes because you can actually show students relationships of how it actually is, okay? And maps don't really communicate the same thing that a globe does. There's something really neat about showing, like, going around the globe. And if it's 3 foot wide, I mean, it's really big, so everyone can see it. So I love my globe. The one last year, my globe developed a hole in it, and it deflated, so I actually had to buy another one. So that was sort of sad, I guess. So I also use a lot of primary sources. I talked about the Boston Massacre, where you had the captain's version and the Boston Gazette's version. I don't know if I used them well. Some days I do, and some days I don't. Because primary sources, actual letters, actual pictures, actual texts, and so on, they just take a lot of prep time. You can find resources online for lots of primary documents. They're good resources. But sometimes what happens is they're like, I want a primary document for this idea. I go to the Library of Congress or the there's a Gilder Learman, I think it is, that I use sometimes. And I'm like, sweet, click print, read over it, do a few things. And my students are reading over it and they're like, what's this thing even trying to say? And I'm like, oh, yeah, we're struggling through some old English here. And so primary sources take work to help your students read through them. Now, 25% of your students might be fine with them, okay? But the other 75 are on a spectrum of understanding it or not. And making sure that all your students are on board with what they're actually reading and how to actually read it is very important. Students love image analysis, I found. Okay, putting on, if you have a projector, putting an image on the projector and just, like, what do you see? What do you think they're doing? Why do you think the artist portrayed it in this way? Or why do you think the photographer took this image, and so on, is really helpful. I also use supplemental trade books, and so I've copied chapters out of The Earth is the Lord's by John Ruth for Anabaptist history. And if you would throw The Earth is the Lord's is a book that's about that fat with endnote sections that's as long as a regular book. And if you would throw that book on your student and say, read this, they'd be like, no way. Okay. But if you copy a chapter out of it, it's actually really good stuff. Okay. And I've had students who have read the section on the last Native Americans of Lancaster County, which actually ended up being killed in the Lancaster County prison, which is now the Fulton Opera House. Okay, not very many of you are from Lancaster County, but I've had students be like, that's not right. And like, this is something that is a half hour from where we live. Okay. Our Anabaptist forefathers actually were living at this time and living very close to the last Native American village in Lancaster County. Okay. Helps bring in tension. Okay. What would have you done if a people group would have been targeted and killed in your local area? I'm not saying you don't need to become all activist-y and saying, you know, write letters to congressmen or whatever. But, like, it helps bring out tension and helps bring personal stories to light. I have something that I call an infographic. This is sort of an example, but it's sort of a way of using pictures and images and a timeline to sort of create a summary of an issue. Okay, and so I will. I do this one for the Protestant Reformation, and a lot of times they're sort of oversimplified, but you can talk about the Roman Catholic Church, and then you can have like a giant like explosion or something. Like, you can add your own like graphics, and then you can be like, okay, this is Luther, this is what he believed, here's Calvin, and here's Zwingli, and then here's the Anabaptists, and this is what they believed. And you can have them, like, some students love writing lots of text. Some students like drawing a lot of pictures. And you can, that's okay. Some students can draw and some students can write. Sometimes I do this as a group activity where they're working together on it. You have to be careful with that one because there's always that one student who just, you know, does a free ride along somebody else. I'm not being pessimistic there, I'm just describing reality. I wish I would have brought my example along. I have an example at home, and I was going to bring it along, and it got left in my classroom. But I use infographics as a way of summarizing maybe a unit, and as a way of preparing for review or preparing for the test. Media. So, how many of you have internet access in your classroom? Most of us do. When I first started teaching history, I took over teaching from somebody who was like a walking history textbook. And that was really intimidating because my memory is is not that great. And so I do need to have things written down and so on. And this teacher could just, he was a walking history textbook. And I decided that I'm going to find, like, there's no way that I'm going to be able to do justice to the knowledge that he had. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to find some videos that sort of can engage students and sort of help cover some of the gaps in what I felt were my abilities. Well, I have moved away from showing videos in class. I'm not saying that I don't show any. I sometimes, Ken Burns does documentaries, and he is... He's a very methodical documentary. He's actually sort of like the father of the documentary, but it's not like the airplane zooming down the mountain gorge with the, you know, the cool groovy music and things. And it's more like primary sources, historians talking, like talking heads, with some video. And I've shown a documentary on Lewis and Clark by Ken Burns. They take a long time, and you have to decide whether they're worth it. But I have found that in the current spirit that I feel in our communities, media is a passive thing. And when you show a video, no matter how engaging the content, they like tune out. And it has to be a really current video in order for them to be really engaged. Now, your communities may be different than mine, but I have pulled away from showing videos. I've also pulled away, like, I love doing things like having them listen to a Beatles song, okay, when we're in more recent history, and like analyze the Beatles song. But I'm still not sure, I don't know what I'm going to do with this, because what has happened is these kids can go home and Google Beatles and start listening to the Beatles, and all of a sudden we have kids around school singing songs by the Beatles, okay? That was not my intended purpose of listening to the Beatles, okay? And so I think as our communities sort of take on this, the whole media thing, and we're still working through it as a community. We're not done yet. I think as a history teacher, I've actually pulled back a lot from it, and I probably will continue to do that. Finally, textbooks. Use your textbooks. Maybe all of you do, but I came into the history classroom, and the teacher before me did not use the curriculum's resources. The school didn't have them, and so it was like the textbook and the teacher key, and that was it. And so I created my own worksheets. I created my own tests and so on. The first year it was great because you could pool all things together and stuff. The second year it was sort of nice because you could reuse material from the previous year. Well, 5 years later, I have five folders of American history, 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019. I have no idea what's in them, okay? By the end of last year, I'm like, oh my goodness, like, I know that I have an answer key for this test, but I have no idea where that answer key is. Now, I'm probably a bit more disorganized than some of you, but if you're all about making your own curriculum, make sure you're the kind of person that actually knows how to be organized, okay? So use your textbooks. If your textbook has a test, use it. That's my advice, because I spent the last 5 years making my own tests, and it was really neat year one. By year five, making rigorous tests are really difficult. Now, some of that is because I have 25 to 30 students in a classroom. So assigning an essay that's like 3 pages long that does justice to an entire unit means that I'm reading 100 pages of text. And frankly, I don't really have time to do justice to that. And so if you have a smaller classroom, you might have less problems with that. Okay. It's soapbox time. All right. The soapbox is, I looked it up very briefly, according to the first article that comes up on YouTube, soapboxes were used to elevate speakers on the streets so they could talk about things that they care about. And so I used the word soapbox for a long time and didn't really know what it was. Be careful how you use this wonderful little pronoun. Make sure that when you use the word we, you would be comfortable doing the action that you have linked with we. So, we went into Iraq or we went into Afghanistan and took out the Taliban. Problem. Okay? This particularly happens in American history. We fought the British and won, right? Be careful of that word. My students know, my students keep me accountable to this, because every now and then it slips out and I say we, and they're like, Mr. Nolt, and, you know, I'm chastised. But I think it's very important that you... I always, when I'm talking about the United States of America, I always say the United States, okay? The United States invaded Afghanistan and defeated the Taliban, okay? be careful that the particularly when it comes to war and some of the doctrines that relate to our faith in Jesus. Be careful the slang you use. So, like, take out the Taliban. Okay, there's like, there. I love sensational language. You probably have picked that up in the last 40 minutes or so. But I have to be really careful with that, because taking out something just sort of has like this really raw, unhuman characteristic to it. So be careful some of that language that you use. And it brings me to another soapbox. Something that I'm calling third-person statements. I am not an English teacher, and so I'm not sure if I'm totally using this accurately. But I'm using this, particularly debates that come up in the history classroom are things like the death penalty. Okay? Sometimes it's very easy for us to talk about whether the United States should have the death penalty or not. Okay? And we can actually argue about the death penalty out here. Be careful about that, because the death penalty means that somebody's life is being taken, okay, by someone else. That is an act of violence. It is an act of coercion. It also means that that person meets their maker, and they may not be ready. As a history teacher, as a Christian, you need to be careful about making statements that you would not be comfortable with yourself. And so I have found in the history classroom, when you're talking about controversial things like war and the death penalty and abortion and all this stuff, make sure you're all doing it in the sense of I. So this gets really sticky if you're talking about whether the United States should outlaw abortion or not. Okay, well, abortion's a terrible, terrible sin. However, our Anabaptist forefathers' most creative idea was the separation of church and state. And they had the understanding that the state and the church should be separate. Okay, and I believe that. Okay. Whenever Christianity links itself with power, it has always gone wrong. You can go back to Constantine. You can go back to Charlemagne. You can go back to the moral majority in the United States in the 70s and 80s. Okay. What did James Dobson and Cal Thomas actually do for the Americans' moral code? It's okay if you disagree with me on that. Okay, I mean, I'm okay with us not arriving at the same place, but that's just my soapbox. Western civilization has spread all throughout the world. As I tell my students, McDonald's is found everywhere, and McDonald's is just an inherently Western civilization kind of thing. We have to be careful that we're not arrogant about that. Jesus cares about people, no matter whether the people have indoor plumbing or not. All right? And as history teachers, we need to make sure that we're communicating that. Has Western civilization been superior? If you mean winning, then I guess it's superior, but it's not necessarily, does Jesus care about that? We could probably have a discussion about that. Are there some good things about Western civilization spreading throughout the world? Well, there are some good things, but there's a tension there, okay? Has Christianity spread because of some of the industrialization and colonization? Well, yes, but has it created some animosity towards Christians? Yes. Okay, like there's this tension, be careful what you're promoting in your classroom. And sometimes it just happens in the little adjectives that we use. And I'm not saying I'm a perfect human being, okay? Because we often promote the thing that we know. And so I know about Starbucks. I'm very fine with Starbucks, okay? As of today. All right. Minority groups. Indigenous peoples, African Americans, Catholics, Mennonites. We must respect minority groups. We live in an era where we are blessed, I think, by political correctness. We are also cursed by political correctness, okay? But I think it is perfectly appropriate to use the terms that are culturally appropriate. So, I prefer African American. I prefer indigenous peoples. I sometimes use Native Americans. I try not to use the word Indian, okay? And so trying to be respectful of what minority groups as a whole are experiencing and identify with them. Because you know what? We actually, as a conservative Anabaptist group, can identify with a minority group, okay? All you need to do is go to a place that's not used to having a conservative Anabaptist in the midst, and you get stared at, okay? Your beliefs don't fit in with the rest of American society, okay? And I think in some colleges, conservative Anabaptists actually count towards affirmative action things because affirmative action requirements because conservative Anabaptists are considered a minority group. We actually can identify with minority groups. Okay. Have our ancestors been taken advantage of as much as the African Americans? No. Okay. But if you go back to the Revolutionary War, if you go back to the Civil War, if you go back to World War I, World War II, Vietnam, our people have found themselves on the outside of popular opinion. And the evangelicals are saying, oh, there's so much persecution going on in America with Christians and so on. We could have told them that as conservative Anabaptists. Okay, like, it's not new, all right? And so identify with minority groups and be very respectful of them. Help your students see reasons why the African American in America sees American history differently than they do, okay? There are reasons. And, you know, almost every year during the Civil Rights Movement, when I'm talking about the African American experience in the United States, I start tearing up because Rosa Parks and the Civil Rights Movement of 1963 happened when my grandpa was 30 years old, which is the age I am. Okay? Now, my grandpa didn't get travel as much as I did in my lifetime, but if I would have taken my group of students to Williamsburg, like if I'd be my grandpa, okay, at age 30, and I would have taken my group of students to Williamsburg, Virginia, some of my students would have had to use a different restroom and couldn't have eaten at a restaurant with the rest of us. That's sad. Okay? One of the other things that comes up in history classes is Mennonite shame. Inevitably, we will talk about in history class. It's just like a giant, like pull the paper out of the hat, you know. And here's a discussion. And in some point in your history class, you're going to talk about Mennonites, and students will say some stereotypes about Mennonites that you might agree with. But be careful when you agree with them. So here's a stereotype. Mennonites don't tip very well. I always followed up with this question. What real-life situation can you tell me that that's actually true? I've yet to find a story where they say, well, we went out to eat with my uncle and he didn't tip. I've never experienced it. Now, I'm sure it's experienced somewhere, but I never experienced it. So is it true? I don't know. Maybe we should have a survey. How much do you tip, Mennonites? Okay. Another Mennonite shame thing is we love a bargain, right? Like, Mennonites are, quote, cheap. No, we're not. We're human beings. Okay? If it would just be Mennonites who believe in being cheap, 50% off sales would only happen at Good Store and Ken's Educational Joys. And trust me, the concept of 50% off did not come from Good Store or Ken's Educational Joys. Okay, they're Mennonite businesses, for those of you who don't know. My parents went to a trade conference, and they went with some of my dad's coworkers. And one of these individuals, when they went to like a stand that had free things, they had a giant bag, and they'd take several and put it in the bag. These people didn't go out for breakfast because the one of them would actually get enough free food from walking around the conference that they would eat free food for breakfast the next morning. Okay, their last name was not Martin or Zimmerman or Brubaker or something. Okay. We are human beings, all right? Mennonites are remarkably human. And all the arguments that, like, put Mennonites in this category of other and backwards and whatnot, we're not more gullible than the general populace. You know, there's these health fads that some people believe in and some people don't. And some people who don't believe in them say, like, Mennonites are so gullible. No, we're not. We're human. There's a whole brand with a bunch of cheap stuff called As Seen on TV. That's being gullible, okay? Believing that you can get an attachment that goes onto your faucet that peels an egg and all those kinds of things. That's being gullible, okay? But it's shown on TV and there's a 1-800 number to call, okay? Mennonites are human beings. Try to get your students to see that we are remarkably normal, okay? There's plenty of shame that goes along with being Mennonite that's actually not warranted. Another one is evangelism, okay? We think we don't evangelize. Maybe we need to have a discussion as to what that means. Maybe we haven't had as many people say the prayer, okay? But, you know, My wife and I were in Europe, and we were in the Netherlands with my sister-in-law, and we're River Brethren, and the lady's costume of the River Brethren is essentially a plain Dutch costume. And so there were at least, my wife's sitting back there, by the way, there were three instances where we got asked whether we're reenacting the old Dutch way of dressing, okay? And there was actually a Syrian individual who got a picture with my sister-in-law because he thought she was dressed up in traditional Dutch costumes, okay? What does evangelism mean, okay? That's a conversation you should have with your students. Finally, earth care. There's a lot of political popular talk about global warming and so on. You don't have to enter the politics of it all, but the fact is industrialization has ruined the world as they knew it before industrialization, okay? Just imagine when you're driving home today, if you're driving home on an interstate, take a note at how many acres just the width of an interstate takes up. Did you ever notice that? Like a four-lane highway, there's the valley on that side, the valley in the middle, and the valley on the other side. If you take a one-acre property and put it there, like the just a typical acre property, like the width of an interstate is actually like a 1 acre property. Okay, I don't know if you're following. It's a picture in my head, and I often struggle to communicate those pictures in words, but yeah, we haven't taken care of the earth. We have dominated the earth, and we're bearing some of the benefits and the consequences of that today, okay? Share that with your students. You don't have to become a greenie that's, like, driving a Toyota Prius and sipping a skinny latte and all that stuff. Like, you don't have to do those, like, stereotypical greenie things. But as Christians, we are to take care of the earth, okay? It's our purpose is not to remove mountains, okay? Faith is supposed to do that. All right, I will end there. If you want to talk to me more, you can afterwards. Thank you.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.